It's planting season for Illinois farmers, but COVID-19 is affecting the workers that usually make it possible. We'll hear how concerns about coronavirus might keep hundreds of migrant workers out of state and give new opportunities to people recently laid off. Plus, we look back at the literature of past pandemics, including an outbreak of the plague in London more than 300 years ago, and hear that it still resonates today.
The Lord Mayor knew that the plague was on English soil, and they didn't do anything to have provisions for the poor in case it hit London.
And as the coronavirus has continued to spread, so too have scam artists looking to profit off the pandemic. I'm Brian Mackey. That's just ahead on the 21st from Illinois Public Media. Our program airs on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air today, Illinois has more than 31,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and 1,349 deaths. The pandemic is affecting every area of our lives, including the food we eat. So we begin today with two conversations on agriculture, one of Illinois' top industries. Here and across the Midwest, agriculture and immigration policy are deeply connected. For decades, foreign workers have planted, picked, and prepared foods that Americans consume. But COVID-19 has stopped many of those men and women from working the fields this year. That means farmers who rely on foreign guest workers are having to look for help elsewhere, as WILL and Illinois Newsroom's agriculture reporter Dana Cronin explains.
Usually this time of year, Pete Pistorius would be hosting a crew from South Africa on his farm.
Just as anything else in our lives, the pandemic has changed kind of the way we've dealt with our H-2A process or our labor force.
Pistorius helps run a corn and soybean operation in central Illinois. And for the last few years, he's gotten help on the farm through the H-2A visa program. It allows farmers to bring over foreign nationals to fill temporary agricultural jobs.
Our plan was to be able to get three guys over here. And I think the start date we'd requested was like the 25th of March.
March 25th came and went, and still his team from South Africa couldn't make it over because of the lockdown order there.
You know, we're kind of stuck in this limbo situation of we really don't know when they'll be over or whether they'll even make it here for this year's planting season.
That's one of the busiest times on the farm, and Pistorius really relies on those guest workers for help. Other farmers who bring in workers from countries like Guatemala, Honduras, and Nepal, all on lockdown, are facing similar situations.
You know, your first reaction is, you know, what are you going to do?
Then it hit him. There's an entire population of people without work due to the pandemic in his community alone. People like Derek Brown. He worked full-time at the local school district in the maintenance department, doing everything from cleaning to mowing. When his school closed, Brown says they called him in to help sanitize the place, but then that was it. He was no longer needed.
We're at a standstill right now. I mean, when you don't have any kids at school, you know, the kids aren't, you know, getting the school dirty.
Brown used to work at Pistorius Farms and says he's happy to come back and help out.
It's a busy time of year for him. And, you know, so not getting those South Africans, it's kind of helping him out with the situation.
This kind of partnership is playing out in other states, too. In Arkansas, Congressman Rick Crawford launched a program that connects farmers to those out of a job, citing the lack of H-2A workers in the state.
These are people that didn't have jobs that now do. And these are farmers who needed people on their farms. Now they have them.
Derek Brown says there's no comparison between work on the farm and his job at the school.
I mean, I enjoy it. I really do. Farming is not easy work.
That's because in addition to sheer manual labor, farming can require a lot of technical skills, like knowing how to operate a tractor or a combine. Each person Pete Pistorius had hired through the H-2A program had specific training and experience. Now, in addition to Derek Brown, his crew includes a laid-off commercial plumber and a few high school students.
It's going to make us be better at training, maybe be a little more patient, spending time with these people to make sure that they can safely operate the equipment.
Pistorius says training is inherent to the job, but usually he'll train someone who stays on the farm anywhere from 6 months to 6 years.
The unfortunate part is that you're training for a part-time job. And, you know, these people will eventually go back to their regular jobs.
Once schools reopen, Derek Brown will leave the farm and go back to his regular job. And there's a chance that'll happen before it's time to harvest.
We're just trying to get the crop in to start out with. And, you know, just kind of trying to take it one battle at a time.
After all, Pistorius says, he's been farming for 22 years, and so far he's always managed to get the crop in and out.
And that was WILL and Illinois Newsroom's agriculture reporter Dana Cronin, who joins us now on the 21st. Dana, welcome back.
Hi, Brian. Thanks.
We're talking about workers from other countries who usually get H-2A visas, but who've been restricted to coming to the U.S. by the coronavirus pandemic. If you want to join our conversation on agriculture in the age of COVID-19, give us a call at 800-222-9455. Again, our number is 800-222-9455. Dana, as you mentioned, this is a critical time for farmers. What kinds of workers are they contracting with to help out?
Right. So on big farm operations like Pistorius Farms, which I talked about in the piece, they'll typically bring over an initial crew to help with planting. And then come harvest season, they might bring over a few more people. And these people are doing all kinds of jobs, from tilling to spraying to planting. A lot of these jobs are also highly technical, like I briefly mentioned in the piece. You know, these days there's pretty high-tech machinery out in the fields on tractors, combines, what have you. So farmers will choose specific workers through this visa program who have specific skill sets to come over and help out. So not having that option in some cases is definitely hurting farmers right now.
I think we often hear about workers coming from Mexico or other Central American countries, but the farmer you talked to, as we heard, was hiring a crew from South Africa. What other countries do agriculture workers come to Illinois in the Midwest from?
Yeah, workers come from all over the world. So like you said, about 90% of them are from Mexico, where the borders are not closed. So those workers are still able to come in. But the other 10% of workers vary. They come from all over, places like Jamaica, Guatemala, Honduras. And it's countries that are on lockdown that are the problem here. Like I mentioned in the piece, those are countries like Guatemala, Honduras, Nepal, and South Africa in this case.
So in your story, you mentioned a program in Arkansas that connects the unemployed people with farms in the state. Can you tell us more about that program?
Sure. Yeah, that was so interesting because I had been talking to Pete Pistorius, the farmer in the piece, before I'd actually heard about this program. And then I came to find out that this same sort of makeshift employment arrangement is playing out elsewhere. So Congressman Crawford's program is called Arkansas Farm Corps. And the goal is the exact same. It's to pair people who lost work due to the pandemic with farmers who can't get their normal crews. It seems like such an obvious solution. And interestingly, Crawford told me a lot of signups they're seeing in Arkansas are actually from college students. Here's a quick clip.
I thought this was pretty interesting. A student who said he was raised on a farm. He's a college baseball player, but college season was shortened and we're not in school, so I might as well be working on a farm.
And Crawford says some of these college students are even earning credit for working on the farm and for being a part of this program.
So is there anything similar here in Illinois? If someone is listening to this and they are unemployed right now during this pandemic, what's the best way to try and find work on a farm?
So Congressman Crawford told me that he's been chatting with other members of Congress and people in the ag industry to get this program off the ground in other states too. He told me one of those states is Illinois. I haven't been able to find out much more than that, but I imagine we'll be hearing more about that as the pandemic drags on. And you know, if someone is listening right now who's unemployed and may be interested in working on a farm, I would suggest calling your local farmer and seeing if they need help. I know some farmers are reaching out on Facebook or other social media, so that could be another option. But that would be my advice to get started.
Do you need any sort of special training to do this kind of work or background?
Not to my knowledge, at least according to Pete Pistorius, the farmer I talked to in the piece, he seemed to be doing most of the training on site. And he said he would likely reserve some of those more technical jobs for himself or for other farm co-owners who have a bit more experience.
All right. That is Dana Cronin. She's WILL and Illinois Newsroom's agriculture reporter. Dana, thanks for sharing your story with us and coming on the show.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you.
A new development on this front late last night. President Donald Trump said he would sign an executive order to suspend immigration into the U.S. So what is the effect of that, as well as COVID-19, on H-2A foreign workers? Joining us now is Sky Chetty with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. He's looked into H-2A workers in the meatpacking industry. Sky, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So if you want to join our conversation, share your experience, or if you have a question for our guest, you can always give us a call, 800-222-9455. Again, that number is 800-222-9455. So Sky, as I just said, you've done reporting on H-2A workers. If people are not necessarily familiar with the lingo, what is somebody who is here on an H-2A visa?
Yeah, well, Section 218 of the Immigration Nationality Act authorizes the lawful admission of temporary non-immigrant workers to perform agricultural labor or services of a temporary or seasonal nature. And all that means is workers, like Dana said, mainly from Mexico, are granted visas from anywhere from a few months to almost a year to come in and perform any kind of agricultural type of service. A lot of it is picking fruits and vegetables that the nation relies on.
So it's been about 14 hours since the president made this announcement, as he often does on Twitter, that he would be suspending immigration into the U.S. What are you hearing about how this will affect workers who are here or want to come here on H-2A visas?
I just checked before coming on. I haven't seen anything officially from USDA or the Department of Labor, but I imagine that there will be some kind of carve out for H-2A workers. In March, when the U.S. Embassy in Mexico announced that they would no longer be processing these because of concerns related to the coronavirus, the agriculture industry really kicked into high gear to force the government to come up with a solution to that. And so I imagine they, if there wasn't any carve out, they would kind of go through the same thing and try to force one. Okay. Just last week, the USDA announced that farmers can hire H-2A workers who are already in the country and whose visas are expiring. Okay. So that's one possible solution.
How many workers are we talking about in the U.S. and in Illinois, if you know that breakdown?
So, yeah, last year there was about 250,000 that came to the U.S., and Illinois typically gets about 1,000 in a year.
Okay. So even before this latest news from the president, the coronavirus was affecting workers possibly being brought here, as we've been talking about this morning. What have you found about, you know, these frontline workers?
Yeah, well, like most frontline workers, they're more susceptible to the virus. You know, working in the fields, they're usually pretty close together. And sometimes they're not provided the proper sanitation that they need. Hmm. And also their living conditions, they live in very cramped, close quarters, and that just makes social distancing very difficult. I believe there are guidelines that employers have been issued to promote social distancing. But there's a story a couple weeks ago from the Arizona Republic. A reporter out there spoke with an employer who admitted that he hadn't followed those guidelines just because it would have interfered with the work.
We're talking with Sky Chetty, reporter with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, who's been looking at the meatpacking industry and H-2A foreign agricultural workers. What kind of protections do these workers have while they're working during the outbreak? I know you said social distancing can be very difficult when you're working in a meatpacking plant. So what kind of protections do they get?
Well, at least initially, the reports that they didn't have much. In Sioux City, South Dakota, the Smithfield plant that's closed down, kind of the major meatpacking outbreak, the AP reported that workers received, quote, very flimsy masks. They're apparently made out of like hairnet material. At another plant in mid-Missouri, the Columbia, Missouri, reported that workers had not received masks until very recently. And here in Illinois, ABC7 in Chicago reported that in a plant on the south side of Chicago, workers still had not received any masks. And so at least initially, there are initial reports that workers were not really getting the protection that they needed.
So we've only got about 15 seconds left in our conversation here, but I just wonder, do workers in these situations, I mean, I imagine they still need the money. Do they feel compelled to keep coming to work?
Yes, a lot of them. There have been reports of that as well. ProPublica has spoken with workers who said, you know, they need the paycheck. They still need the paycheck. And also companies have kind of encouraged that. The Argus Leader in South Dakota reported that Smithfield had promised to pay workers a $500 bonus if they did not miss work. So that's another part of the equation.
Wow. Actually encouraging people to come in the middle of a pandemic. Okay. That is Sky Chatty. He's a reporter with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, covering the meatpacking industry and H2A foreign agricultural workers. Sky, thanks for coming on the 21st.
No problem. Thanks.
You are listening to the 21st. We've got more coming up after a break. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
It's the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. When living through troubling times, experiences that for most of us are new and frightening, there can be a certain comfort in learning that people have been through this sort of thing before. Off and on through much of the last millennium, Europeans faced down the Black Death, the bubonic plague, and documented it in stories.
I am a scarecrow, alias HF, your representative, roaming about a diseased, torn London, and fascinated by everything, making notes as I go.
This is from a BBC documentary dramatizing Daniel Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year. It's a work of fiction, but heavily grounded in fact, documenting how the Black Death killed tens of thousands of people in London in 1665. Defoe was a child during that outbreak and wrote the journal in 1722 as another episode of the plague was threatening England. Another bubonic plague-inspired work was written nearly 400 years before that, Boccaccio's The Decameron, a collection of short stories about a group of wealthy young people trying to escape another bout of the plague in Italy in 1348. Joining us to talk about these works and how they resonate today are Elizabeth Zold. She's an English professor at Winona State University and earned her PhD here at Illinois State. And Eleonora Stepino, professor of Italian and director of the program in medieval studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Elizabeth and Nora, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Elizabeth, I want to begin with you. Can you tell me who was Daniel Defoe?
Daniel Defoe was a very prolific author. He was writing at the end of the 17th and the early 18th century. He is probably best known for his book, Robinson Crusoe, which is often credited as being one of the first English novels. He was a reporter. He wrote many tracts. He wrote a really interesting tract about how he thought women should be educated, which was, for that time, very progressive. And most of his books, including Journal of the Plague Year, are very realistic. So his novels are known for their realism, for getting people inside a character's head and kind of letting them see the world through that character's eyes.
And Nora, same question. Who was Boccaccio?
Boccaccio, his first name, Giovanni Boccaccio, he was born near Florence in 1313. And he was the illegitimate son of a merchant, Boccaccino, and a woman who remains fairly mysterious to us. And throughout his life, he was a very prolific author. Before the 40s, he had written mostly highly experimental texts of about love, unhappy love. And then the year that really changes everything is 1348, when the plague hits Florence. We don't know exactly where Boccaccio is at this point, but we do know that the plague becomes the center of his most famous work, the Decameron.
Elizabeth, can you talk about what prompted Daniel Defoe to write about the plague that struck London in 1665? I mean, if I remember correctly, he was only, 5 years old when that happened?
Yes, so he was only 5 years old. Journal of the Plague Year was actually published in 1722, and it was part of a group, or not a group, it's sort of a series of texts that had been published or republished about the plague. And that was because in 1720, there was an outbreak of the plague in Marseille, France. And that lasted until about 1722. And there was, you know, a lot of worry that the plague was actually going to spread and it's going to make its way back over to England. And so Defoe, when he was writing, he went back and he was looking at this plague from 1665, and the narrator of the text only goes by HF. And many scholars credit that as actually standing for Henry Foe, who was Defoe's uncle. Defoe added the aristocratic Day to his name, so his last name is actually Foe, and he changed it. And so he looked at his uncle's journals, and then no doubt that he was talking to people who were alive through that time to get some of their perspectives. Journal of the Plague Year was actually published kind of as a warning and perhaps a guidebook. So if the plague were to come back, people would know what worked, what didn't work, what to do, what not to do. That's kind of why he went back, and that was his inspiration for writing.
And yeah, it does read like sort of half story narrative, like half New Yorker and half CDC pamphlet in terms of all the statistics.
Yes, exactly. He was meticulous about making that sort of realism. And when you read it, there is sort of a question about how much of this is fiction, how much do you fictionalize, and how much is he pulling from directly from sources. And so that's where it's really that interesting kind of historical fiction, not just a straight fictional story.
And what was the plague year like on the ground for people in London in 1665, in Defoe's telling?
The sounds, I think, are one of the things that strike me the most. HF is a narrator who, in part because he has to tell us the story of London, as he's walking through the streets, he describes hearing people yelling in pain at some of the highest points when the plague is everywhere. And you can hear people screaming and crying in pain in their houses. And there's sort of this stench in the streets, and there's fear everywhere. You know, he's walking down these twisting, winding, narrow streets of London that he knows very well. And he's concerned because what if it's a narrow passageway and someone else is walking past? And it always makes me, now it makes me think of the social distancing, you know, walking down an aisle in a store, you have to be careful, you don't get too close to someone. And so there's just this fear and confusion, and no one is quite certain what to believe in terms of what other people are doing, how far it's gotten. This was the bubonic plague. So this was mostly caused by the bite of the black rat flea. There is the pneumonic plague, which is spread by droplets. Many of them at that time believed that it was spread through the air. And so they were very concerned with covering their faces. And so it's just this sort of culture of fear and paranoia, and being afraid of your neighbors and how they might, you know, if they might accidentally kill you or come in and steal your things. There were a lot of looters. So it's just a time of fear, and it seems to be rampant, whether it's through seeing people dying in the streets or hearing people crying or seeing people looting, things like that. So it's just a very stressful, anxious time.
So Nora, we understand the journal to be a sort of fictionalized, but also statistics heavy or fact heavy account. What is the Decameron?
The Decameron is a macro text, we call it. It's a collection of tales, 100 of them, that Boccaccio imagines were told by a group of 10 young people who run away from Florence precisely to escape the plague. His frame, the pretext for what happens in the Decameron is this fear of contagion, very similar to what Elizabeth is describing. And this is what Boccaccio envisions. One day, as all social connections, family connections are breaking down, and as everyone is getting sick, these seven women meet in a church in Florence and decide to run away, to seek refuge in the countryside. They bring along three men, and they retreat to a beautiful villa, we can imagine, where they decide to tell tales to pass time. Two things come together in Boccaccio's imagination. One is this total breakdown of human society, and the other is the attempt to reconstruct a society in this fake happy place outside of Florence, where they tell stories to keep death at bay.
You know, it strikes me that both of these stories deal with, I think, what today we call privilege. Nora, I mean, this is something that, I mean, I'm imagining people you hear about in New York who've gone to their summer home in the Hamptons, or in Chicago going to their homes in Michigan and Wisconsin.
Yes, that's very, that sounds very familiar, because the 10 youths of the Decameron are really extremely privileged. They take their servants, and their defense from the plague is also a defense from all elements of class unrest that they can be subject to. So when they reach their destination, they make a pact that they will never speak of what's happening outside, which is quite interesting. Boccaccio is a very interesting author in this sense, though, because as the tales progress, you can really see the plague seeping back in, as well as the lives of those servants who make their privileged life possible. And so there's a point in the text where the servants sort of come back and re-enter the stories, which is quite interesting to me, as we see the backlash against people who can freely go to another location and let time pass
and escape or hope or try to escape,
right,
the ravages of the disease. Yeah. And Elizabeth, Defoe's narrator early in the story describes the endless parade of people of the better sort and horsemen attending them, all fleeing London for the countryside. Can you talk a little bit about Defoe's treatment of the rich and everyone else?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. He talks about how, I'll get to the rich in just a moment, but first he early on is angry with the Lord Mayor that they had 6 months, so they had plenty of time knowing that this plague was coming outside of the city walls. They could see what they would get was a weekly bill of mortality. So weekly, this publication would come out saying how many people have died, of what, and where. And so early on, they get this bill of mortality that says two people have died of the plague in one parish. And it's a bit further out, and then it kind of waxes and wanes, and they hear something and it goes away, and then it starts to build. So the Lord Mayor knew that the plague was on English soil, in the city of, in the sort of outskirts of London, not in the city proper. And they didn't do anything to have provisions for the poor in case it hit London. So despite knowing that this might happen, there was nothing for the poor to help them. And so Defoe talks about, or HF rather, talks about how, you know, the poor couldn't stock up on food. They weren't able to buy a bunch at once and then hold themselves away. And so they were putting themselves at risk, having to go to the market more often. They also had to take on the jobs that no one else wanted to do, like picking up the dead and standing guard as watchmen over houses of the sick, or sometimes even going in and checking on the people who are in the sick houses. And so, of course, they had the highest rates of death. And in the meantime, as you're talking about, the rich had fled the city. They were fleeing to their country homes. And then in a moment of sort of maybe feeling guilt, they were actually the ones who sent money to help the poor of London. And so they sent money, and then the Lord Mayor handed sort of that out later on. So they were sort of sending money back, but yes, they had fled. And he tells Defoe tells a story of someone coming back too soon. So watching those bills of mortality and seeing the numbers slowly go down, and one man who was out in the country with his family, he had like five or six people with him, his children, his wife, and a couple of servants, decided to go back to the city because the numbers were dwindling. And HF, the narrator, tells us that it was too soon just because the numbers had dipped and the whole family ended up dying.
Wow.
So there's some interesting things there. And of course, talking about how when they fled to the country, they actually were bringing the plague with them. So they weren't escaping it. So all of these sorts of ways that the plague was spread, and just simply by virtue of social class.
So we've only got a minute left, but I just want to ask both of you if there are lessons we can learn from these stories to apply to our present situation. Nora, the Decameron first.
Well, I would say there are three things that I find very important in the lessons of the Decameron. One, the pleasure of reading and telling stories. I think right now we all appreciate more, even though our attention span may be limited, the importance of reading and narrating. The other is precision in what we say and how we say it. Boccaccio's description of the plague is so precise and to the point that it helps us understand the scientific evidence. Historians have used Boccaccio's narration for reconstruction purposes, and that's a good lesson to us, I think, as we think about what's going on and try to describe it to ourselves and to others. And the final and most important thing is the first sentence of the Decameron, which is that it is human to be compassionate. Umana cosa è la compassione. And I, even though Boccaccio uses it in his love tales, and for him, compassion is mostly compassion for who has been unhappy in love. I think there is no better feeling for each other right now than being kind.
And Elizabeth, are there lessons we can take from the journal for today?
I think so. One of the things that strikes me most about this book is that it's really about information. And how are we getting information? How much information are we taking in? At what point does information stop helping and start hurting in terms of being overwhelmed or being afraid and making us do things that we maybe normally wouldn't do? Or, you know, what kind of information can we trust? What is our source? Is it hearsay? Is it something that you can count on? Because so much of the information in this book are hard numbers that he's taken from official places, but it's also a lot of hearsay, right? Like, oh, I heard this or I heard that, right? And so, so much of this is about how we gain information and what we do with it, and how we can sort of keep from being overwhelmed by it, which is something that I know that I struggle with. You want to know more, but at the same time, that's also overwhelming. And I think, you know, lastly, at the end of the day, he talks so much about people doing kind of bad things or having bad reactions. to the plague and going in and looting and stealing, or, you know, even these stories of nurses killing their patients and things like this and all these horrible things. But at the end of the day, there are so many other people in the stories who are trying to help other people and who are looking out for other people. It's sort of that idea that if you look around, you know, who is trying to do their best in the face of something this horrible? And I think that's something that we can take away from that.
Elizabeth Zold is a professor of English at Winona State University. She earned her PhD at Illinois State University in Bloomington Normal. And we've also been speaking with Eleonora Stapino, who's a professor of Italian and director of the program in medieval studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Elizabeth and Nora, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As the coronavirus has continued to spread, so too have the number of scammers looking to profit off the pandemic. Local and federal authorities are warning about fake miracle cures, con artists promising financial relief, and store owners jacking up prices on hot commodities like toilet paper. Even the government is worried about getting scammed right now.
Millions of medical masks purchased by the state of Illinois from China may not be able to be used the way they were intended. It comes after a neighboring state found some of their inventory was either ineffective or counterfeit.
Brett Chase has been reporting on fraud for the Better Government Association, and he's with us now for more. Brett, glad to have you back on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
And if you have gotten a call or email from a scammer recently related to the coronavirus, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. Again, that number is 800-222-9455. So, Brett, here in Illinois, the Federal Trade Commission has, I guess, gotten hundreds of fraud complaints related to the coronavirus outbreak over the past few weeks, or filed them, I should say. Nationwide, we've seen 17,000 fraud complaints totaling millions of dollars. I mean, is it common to see an uptick in scams around some sort of disaster scenario?
There's always scams around big disasters, hurricanes, floods, things like that. This, of course, is unlike anything we've ever seen. And those numbers you just quoted are actually even, you know, up from, you know, when my story ran recently last week. I'm looking at FTC website right now, and those reports are up to about 23,000 for a total fraud loss of $17.5 million, a medium fraud loss of $553. And in state of Illinois, that number has jumped, you know, again, since my story ran, to we have 730, and that's just to the Federal Trade Commission. So these are complaints that are going to, you know, make their way to the federal government. Sometimes if you call Better Business Bureau, they're going to, you know, they're going to contribute to that database. But, you know, separately, we have local communities taking fraud complaints. We have the state taking fraud complaints. You have a whole array of government agencies at the federal level that are, you know, taking complaints because these scammers are using anything they can to, you know, to try to make themselves look legitimate, whether they're posing as Medicare or as, the FEMA, for instance. You know, there's lots of promises to do, get those stimulus checks if you just, you know, give them some personal information. So there's a whole bunch of things going on right now.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. So there have been, scams involving these stimulus checks. There's a $2.2 trillion in the Federal CARES Act. So what sort of fraud are we talking about as related to these, you know, fake federal aid scammers?
You might get a phone call. You might get a text. you might get, you know, an email. You know, there's all sorts of things like that. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, you're probably not getting as much, you know, in mail, you know, snail mail, but, you know, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get these legitimate looking emails. You know, they look like they're coming from, you know, a trusted government agency or some trusted, you know, organization. You might get, you know, you'll get a lot of direct calls. I've talked to people who got, you know, direct calls, and, you know, even a text, you know, hey, you know, contact us. We've got your money, or we got you know, some masks, or we got a cure, or, you know, there's all sorts of stuff.
And this is not the sort of thing that I would imagine inspires your local police department to snap to attention and deploy all their resources, right?
I think they're going to be busy with a lot of other stuff right
yeah.
now. Honestly, you know, so I mean, I'm here in Chicago, and city of Chicago, you know, asks people to call 311. But some of those, you know, those complaints then get funneled to a consumer affairs department here. And then at the state level, you've got the Illinois Attorney General, and they're fielding a ton of price gouging complaints right now. Not as much of the consumer fraud that I just mentioned, but, mm-hmm. you know, just like 1,300, yeah, I mean, 1,300 and counting, I should say, complaints of price gouging compared to, you know, not very many. I don't have the exact number at the state level, but just for comparison's sake, you know, City of Chicago fielded 2 price gouging complaints in all of 2019. In March and through the early part of April, they had more than 400 complaints.
A little quick math, that's a, from, what, 200,000% increase? I don't know. It's like, that is a 200-fold increase.
Big.
Yeah. So yeah. What sort of price gouging are we talking about? Do you have any examples here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, boxes of toilet paper going from $50 to $80. You know, we've got, you know, outrageous.
$80 for a case of toilet paper. Wow.
I will give you the caveat that, you know, these are allegations.
Sure.
You know, I talked to a store owner on the south side of Chicago who said, you know, I was never actually selling this for $80. I was joking to a customer that I'm not going to sell, you know, my entire inventory. I'd have to charge you a crazy amount of money. But then, interesting enough, he showed me a receipt, and we put this in our story, a receipt from his supplier. And sure enough, he paid $50 for 36 rolls of toilet paper, you know, which he said was more than double what he normally buys from this wholesaler. So I mean, that was an interesting, you know, proof that some of this stuff is going on.
Yeah. Wow. That is an incredible price. But I mean, I guess this is, I've heard stories of people, you know, with chickens trading eggs for toilet paper. I mean, people are getting desperate for this product.
We're paying up, and some of that is going to be, you know, somewhat legitimate, but, you know, I mean, the governor has said, you know, you're not going to profit off of this. You know, it's this, I mean, there's the state of Illinois is going after this a couple different ways. I mean, there's already consumer fraud, you know, and price gouging laws on the books, but then in addition, you know, with the governor's disaster declaration, then that gives the state a little bit more, you know, teeth on this matter. Although I will say that with this big influx, what the Illinois Attorney General's office tells me is that, you know, they're trying to just, you know, mitigate as much as they can.
Yeah.
You know, they're not prosecuting anybody right now. They're calling businesses. They're like, you know, if you're price gouging, you better knock it off. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, or we're looking at you. And so there haven't really been any prosecutions, and even, like here in, you know, Chicago's a big city, you know, there's only been like a couple citations, or at least at the time of publication, there were only, you know, a couple citations. It's, you have like a handful of people in this case, you know, going out and trying to check these stores. And of course, when they get there, well, you know, those $50 boxes of toilet paper are already sold out. So, you know, there's a lot of hysteria too. I mean, people are, you know, are hitting the phones because they feel like they're getting ripped off. And, you know, but it does seem like there's enough out there that there is, you know, some legitimate price gouging going on.
Yeah. And the last thing real briefly, I want to ask you about are miracle cures, right? Teas, vaccines. Is that kind of thing happening as well?
Yeah. And I don't, you know, again, I don't have like a concrete example of it happening in Illinois other than, well, I mean, you know, talking to the Better Business Bureau, I mean, they've been getting complaints about it. They're investigating. These investigations can take a while. At the federal level, they've moved fairly swiftly on some of these matters, like the Federal Drug Administration. Anytime you have sort of, these false medical claims, they're going to get involved. And they and the FTC jumped on some of these things, including some pretty notable people like Jim Baker, the former televangelist who went to jail all those years ago. He has a TV show where he was he's touting this like silver cream. And he said that this was going to. I saw that you can Google it and see the video online.
Yeah.
He was saying that this stuff's going to take care of that COVID-19. So FDA and FTC said you need to knock that off. And
yeah. Wow. All right. Brett Chase is a senior investigator for the Better Government Association. He's been telling us about the thousands of fraud complaints that federal and local officials have gotten during the coronavirus pandemic. Brett, thanks for coming on the show today.
Yeah. Sure.
I also want to welcome into the conversation Terry Warman, who's Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach for AARP Illinois. She's on the line with us now. Terry, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And just a reminder to our listeners, if you've gotten a call or an email from a scammer recently and would like to share your experience, you can join our conversation by calling 800-222-9455. So, Terry, we've been talking to Brett, and I'm bring him back in a moment, but I'm sure none of what we've been talking about comes as a surprise to you, right? We've seen an uptick in scams along with the pandemic, but elderly people who are older adults, they're often targeted for scams year-round. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, really, the scammers like to really capitalize on the news of the moment. And whether you're a senior or almost all of us, I mean, we're at home, we're high anxiety, we're really, we're wanting information, we're wanting to make sure that we're all safe. And so the scammers are just taking advantage of that. And some of the things that they have done over the years, they're doing it again. And now it's just under the guise of COVID-19 and the pandemic.
And is there a stigma to reporting this kind of fraud? Is there any sort of sense of maybe shame at having been tricked or something like that? And what do you say to people who find themselves in that position?
Well, certainly. And we know that for many older adults, or probably even you or I mean, if we really fell for something and going, oh, why did I do that? But there's a whole lot of fear about reporting it. Oftentimes, people also have just a hard time being able to tell what is a scam and what's not. And because we are in a heightened state of anxiety, that our logical brain stops sometimes when we hear something instead of stepping back, where we just get pulled into it. And so, there are a lot of examples of scams. Our AARP Fraud Watch Network helpline has been getting a whole lot of examples of those kinds of things that are happening.
Just real briefly, can you give me one quick example of like what does a scam look like now in the COVID-19 pandemic?
Obviously, they're playing to the fears around face masks, because certainly seniors, they want the potential out to the store or whatever, but they don't even know where to get masks. And so getting an email or a phone call that says, you can get these products from us. Whole idea of one of my volunteers actually sent us, there's a text that's going around, says someone who came in contact with you tested positive or has shown symptoms for COVID-19 and recommends you self-isolate or get tested. And there's a link. That's a scam. And the link, if you click on it, they're potentially going to be asking for information, et cetera. And so people being very careful on clicking any sort of email links, text links, offering treatments, go here, and donations, charities is kind of a big thing right now. And so people can actually check on charities by going to the Better Business Bureau, their www.give.org, for example. You can go and check them. And then if I might offer, AARP has our toll-free helpline at 877 908-3360. And you can be a person of any age. You don't have to be a member. You just want to check something out. You want to report something. They're taking those calls, and they can do it in multiple languages. So better safe than sorry in this particular instance.
Okay. And Brett, just in about 30 seconds here, I mean, is you kind of mentioned that the Attorney General's office, at least in terms of the price gouging, is not doing a lot of prosecuting. Is anyone investigating these kind of scam complaints right now? And again, in about 30 seconds?
I think there's a lot of organizations, you know, from the FBI to the FTC to, you know, I mentioned FDA and you know, Better Business Bureau, which has been mentioned. I mean, they're looking into these things as well. So, yeah, there's a real joint operation going on, I'd say.
All right. Brett Chase is a senior investigator for the Better Government Association. We've also spoken with Terry Warman. She's Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach for AARP Illinois. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
And that number, again, if you feel like you want to report fraud that Terry mentioned, is 877-908-3360. On a programming note, tomorrow we are expecting to bring you an interview with Tim Killeen, the president of the University of Illinois System. We're actually taping that interview this afternoon, Tuesday afternoon. So if you have a question you would like us to ask President Killeen, send us an email, talk@21stshow.org. Even better yet, send a voice memo. That address again is talk@21stshow.org. The 21st is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Stay well, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.